to Studio Tulsa. I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. If you're a regular listener, you may have heard a recent interview we did about ACEs, adverse childhood experiences, that are traumas occurring to youngsters that wind up affecting health throughout their lifespans. Even if we're fortunate enough to grow up with a low or normal ACE score, we can experience trauma directly or vicariously across our own lifespans. Mass shootings, hate crimes, political division, natural disasters, and war are just some of the news events that can stir up emotion and lead many of us to feel anxious, fragmented, or downright depressed. My guest today, Dr. James Gordon, has written a new book titled The Transformation that is a guide to healing after trauma, whether experienced directly or via world events that foment unease and possibly lead to post-traumatic stress in many of us. Gordon is a psychiatrist by training, and he founded and still directs the Center for Mind-Body Medicine, via which he teaches and trains scores of professionals in methods of healing and relaxation, some of which we'll experience here on air today. Dr. Gordon's writings have appeared in the New York Times, Washington Post, The Atlantic, The Guardian, and he's appeared on programs such as 60 Minutes, Good Morning America, and on NPR. Dr. James Gordon, founder and director of the Center for Mind-Body Medicine, and author of the new book, The Transformation, Discovering Wholeness and Healing After Trauma, is my guest today on Studio Tulsa Medical Monday. Dr. James Gordon, welcome back to Medical Monday. Congratulations on your new book, The Transformation. I want to start by talking about trauma and your major assertion early on. I didn't really recognize this, but in effect, we're all victims of trauma. And we tend to think of people who've been abused or neglected or lived through natural disasters or warfare as victims of trauma. But in fact, we all are. Can you describe that?
Sure. You know, it's really important for us to understand. This is an understanding that human beings up until the present always had. And now, you know, we're lost in a kind of fog of belief that everything can be perfect and in order all the time for most of us. And they're just those other strange people or poor people who've been horribly affected by, as you say, wars, climate-related disasters, or terrible abuse. In fact, if trauma doesn't come early because of early childhood neglect or abuse, which is unfortunately very common, including among middle-class families here in the United States, or from poverty or discrimination early on, then in our adult lives, our young adult lives, we deal with situations like divorce or loss of a job that meant a great deal to us, or disappointment in our expectations of ourselves, or illness, our own illness, or somebody close to us has a serious illness. So those are all traumatic. And then if we live long enough, we have to deal with frailty in our bodies, with the loss of loved ones, and with our own death. So trauma is very much a part of life and is not apart from it. And understanding that, although it may feel a bit like a rude awakening, it actually becomes kind of comforting because we understand that when things come to us, it's not so strange. It's not something that puts us outside the pale and makes us so different from other people. It's part of what makes us human, is that we do experience trauma at one point or another.
Yeah, I like the way you frame that because there's comfort in community. And when you frame it that way, that we all, in a sense, are victims of trauma, there is, oddly enough, some comfort about that. I want to ask you spend an early part of the book or an early chapter really talking about the physiology of trauma and what it does to our brains and our bodies. And I was wondering if you had a concise way, because it's, you know, you've written it out very clearly and beautifully, of summarizing. And I guess you probably give talks and lectures. So trauma impacts our fight or flight response, which is evolutionarily designed to help us avoid danger. But when it's constantly triggered, it can be detrimental to us.
That's it. I really appreciate one physician to another that you're saying my explanations are clear. That's great. I meant to be clear for everyone. And I think the point about trauma is that the reactions that we have when we're traumatized are either, as you said, fight or flight, which is a life-saving response mediated by our sympathetic nervous system, which is one half of our automatic nervous system. It either prepares us to duke it out with a predator or to get out of there, to leave. And our genes tell us or are meant to tell us, are we supposed to stay and fight or are we supposed to go away? The thing about fight or flight is that it's meant to be turned on very quickly to save us and then turned off just as quickly. If you think about, if you've seen a nature film and you see an antelope, say, on the Serengeti Plain in Africa, a lion starts chasing her. If the lion catches up, the story's over. But if she gets away, 3 minutes later, she's happily grazing. The fight or flight has come, done its job. It's raised heart rate, raised blood pressure, brought the blood and to the smooth muscles, big muscles in the body, taking it away, taking blood away from the digestive tract because you don't want to stop for a snack if you're fleeing for your life. And then as soon as the threat has gone, the gazelle is back in a balanced state, balancing the fight or flight response of the sympathetic nervous system with the rest and digest response of the parasympathetic nervous system. The problem for we human beings is that we carry the lion with us everywhere we go. So the lion may be a memory of an assault, or the lion that we're thinking about long after the assault is over. It's as if we're still in that dangerous situation. Or alternately, if we're in a very conflicted relationship with a partner at home, or a child at home, or with a boss at work, it's as if the lion is with us all the time. And there's no lion at all, of course. But it's as if we're ready to fight or flight every time we get ready to go into work, or every time we go home. So the issue is not the fight or flight response, which is a life-saving response, but it's prolongation beyond the time when it does us any good. And with the prolongation of fight or flight, we cause all kinds of stress to our body. It contributes to higher blood pressure, high cholesterol, high blood sugar. It makes us anxious. If it goes on long enough, it depletes our adrenal glands of the capacity to respond to stress. We become worn out. So it's something we have to become aware of. We have to become aware of what it feels like, and then we can begin to address the fight or flight response. And then there is the other response that comes with overwhelming trauma, which is the freeze response. So fight or flight is a response that you get if you, like the gazelle, you either escape or you die. In the case of the gazelle, you don't fight a lion. The gazelle's genes are intelligent enough to tell her not to fight the lion. But in a situation which is overwhelming and inescapable, let's say the gazelle is caught by the lion, or you're a soldier and you're in a Humvee and the Humvee gets blown up and your buddy next to you is dead and you can't fight and you can't get out of the Humvee, we go into what's called a freeze response, which is mediated by the oldest part of the parasympathetic nervous system. Technically, it's the vagus nerve that goes deep into our brainstem, and we shut down. We put out a lot of endorphins to relieve the pain. Think of the gazelle in the jaws of a lion. And we get tight and tense, or our body collapses, or both. And again, the problem is not with the freeze response. The problem, because it can be life-saving, the problem is if the freeze response continues beyond the time when it's necessary. And so we're shut down. We're withdrawn from other people. Our bodies are tense and tight. We're kind of like zombies, barely existing.
You're listening to Studio Tulsa. It's Medical Monday. I'm John Chu, and my guest today is Dr. James Gordon, the founder and director of the Center for Mind-Body Medicine and a clinical professor of psychiatry and family medicine at Georgetown University, author of the brand new book, The Transformation, Discovering Wholeness and Healing After Trauma. You have many techniques throughout this book, The Transformation, foremost of which I think is your longest lived tip, or the one that you've been teaching perhaps the longest, called soft belly. And I wondered if you could share soft belly with our listeners. What is it and how does it work?
Sure. It's totally appropriate. It's the first one that we teach. It's very basic. It's very simple. What soft belly does is it balances out the fight or flight response of the sympathetic nervous system with the relaxation response of the parasympathetic nervous system. It's technically a concentrative meditation because you're concentrating on breathing in through the nose and out through the mouth, concentrating on the word soft as you breathe in and belly as you breathe out, and also concentrating on the feeling of the belly being soft and relaxed. So what I'll do is I'll teach it now, and we'll do it just for a few minutes, and people can experience what it's like, and then we can talk a little bit more about the physiology afterwards. So sit comfortably. And I sometimes notice that when I say sit comfortably, I change my own position because I'm not always sitting comfortably. So sit comfortably and allow your breathing to deepen. Breathe in through your nose and out through your mouth. It's a very relaxing way to breathe. Let your eyes close. If your eyes are closed, it removes a great deal of external stimulation. As you breathe in, say to yourself, soft. And as you breathe out, say belly. Focusing on the breath, the words soft and belly, and the feeling of your belly being soft and relaxed. Feel your whole body relax with each exhalation. Thoughts come, let them come and let them go. Gently bring your mind back to soft belly.
Really is relaxing.
That's the idea.
So,
The idea is, this is fundamental technique. This is the beginning of the trauma healing journey. And what it does, yes, it's relaxing, which is great. Some people say, I feel more centered or calmer. When I open my eyes afterwards, I see more clearly. But not only does it provide a specific benefit, but it also shows you that you can make a difference in how you feel. This is really critical. When we've been traumatized, when we're under a great deal of stress, when we have a chronic illness, or we're depressed or really anxious, we often feel like there's nothing we can do. We feel hopeless and helpless. And doing soft belly breathing, yes, I can explain the physiology and say it balances fight or flight, and that's fine and that's important. But even more important is the direct experience of the difference that you're making in how you feel. Just, we did it maybe, 3 minutes, something like that. And you can notice a difference. And about 80% of people who did this with us are likely to have noticed a difference. And that gives you the understanding that you can not only make a difference with soft belly, but maybe there are other ways that you can make a difference in what's going on in your life. And this is a critical part of healing from psychological trauma, and also from healing from depression or anxiety or chronic illness, all these conditions in which we feel that there really isn't much that we can do. We not only put ourselves back in physiological balance so our body and mind can heal more easily, but we also teach ourselves a lesson that we can make a difference in how we feel.
So you make the point in the book that I think for many of your first-timers or people who are sort of new to the techniques of Center for Mind-Body Medicine, that soft belly seems an awful lot like meditation.
Well, it is a kind of meditation. I think the problem is we make meditation into a much bigger deal. And in a way, meditation is a big deal. Meditation should be central to medical care. They come from the same Sanskrit and Greek root word, which means to take care of and to take the measure of, the art and the science of medicine. It's right there. So meditation should be central to medicine, but it doesn't necessarily go with any particular religious tradition. All religious traditions have meditations. Meditation is simply relaxed moment-to-moment awareness. And there are many paths, thousands of different ways, thousands of different kinds of meditation that can bring us into that state. Technically, soft belly breathing is a concentrative meditation. Just as looking at an image is a concentrative meditation, or saying a sound, a mantra, that's a Sanskrit word for sound, to oneself, or saying a repetitive prayer can be understood as a concentrative meditation. Whether you're saying Our Father or Shema Yisrael or Ilalahu Ilalah, those are all concentrative meditations. They're part of every religious and spiritual tradition. There are two other kinds, general kinds of meditation. One is mindfulness. Sanskrit word is vipassana, a Buddhist meditation originally, becoming aware of thoughts, feelings, and sensations as they arise, generally either called mindfulness or awareness meditation. And the third kind is the oldest kind on the planet, and it's expressive meditation. It's using the body, active physical meditations that break up fixed patterns of stress and trauma, fixed mental ideas and emotions about and that we ruminate, that we go over again and again in our mind. Expressive meditations break up those constricting and destructive fixed patterns. All three kinds of meditation are useful, different times for different reasons. And so we teach in the transformation, I teach people how to do all three kinds and different types within each of those kinds as well, because no one kind appeals to everybody.
Well, so yeah, let's contrast soft belly, which to me, it resonates because it reminded me of different kinds of guided imagery or guided meditations that I've done before. And then you have shaking and dancing, which is, you know, markedly different, just a name alone. But take us through how that works.
Sure. I'll take you through it. And people want to look at, see what it's like, they can check out the CMBM website, cmbm.org, and you can see people all over the world shaking and dancing. It's, you know, again, if you think about the physiology and you think about trauma leaving us either in fight or flight, anxious, agitated, hypervigilant, fearful, maybe a little too aggressive, having difficulty concentrating, or frozen, shut down emotionally, tense in our body, or both. Because often after trauma, we are sometimes in fight or flight and sometimes in freeze. So one of the best ways to deal with either of those situations is to get the body moving. Now, all movement and all exercise is good. We human beings are meant to move a great deal more than most of us move in the 21st century. In our ancestors, we carry the same genes as our hunter-gatherer ancestors, and they were moving all the time, walking, lifting, carrying, bending, constantly, all day long. We need to recover some of that mobility. One of the ways to begin to recover it is through a technique like shaking and dancing. So the first phase is shaking. And what you do is you stand up, and as people are listening to us, they're welcome to do it now. You put your feet shoulder width, you bend your knees a little bit, and you start shaking up from your feet, through your knees, hips, chest, shoulders. We carry so much tension in our shoulders. Let your head go and let your jaw hang open. And keep on doing that for, start off maybe 5 or 6 minutes of shaking, just like that. And best, unless you have difficulty with balance, is to close your eyes. That way, if somebody else is there with you, you're doing it with a friend or a partner, you're not checking on that person or comparing yourself. And if you're by yourself, you're eliminating external stimulation. So do that for 5 or 6 minutes and take about 2 minutes just to stand and relax and breathe and feel your body. And then have some music ready that will help you to move your body, music that's inspiring and energizing for you. And different people like different kinds of music. That's an expressive meditation. Altogether, it may take 10, 12, 15 minutes max. And it makes a huge difference. People feel energized. They feel more relaxed. They feel more focused. It's a pathway to that relaxed moment-to-moment awareness. That's the hallmark of meditation of any kind. And it's great. We all should be doing expressive meditations. When I work with people in my office, I almost always prescribe both a quiet meditation, like soft belly breathing, and an expressive meditation like shaking and dancing. And when we work with people who've been severely traumatized, it's really important to use these active, expressive physical meditations right away because they're so tight. I was just doing a training program with the Veterans Administration hospital system, the system in South Florida and Georgia and Southern Georgia and the Caribbean. They serve 800,000 vets. And we're training a couple hundred health coaches and 100 of the clinical leaders in the VA system. And many of them are themselves veterans. And for them, even though they thought it was kind of weird to begin with, which I completely understand, after the shaking and dancing, especially, the vets said, man, that feels so good. I've been so tense. I've been so tight. I'm starting to loosen up. And it was really, it was like a revelation to them. And I think, you know, when we're, so many of us, and us doctors are in many ways just like those vets. We think we can handle anything, right? We go on through no matter how many hours, no matter how emotionally upsetting, how mentally challenging something is, we're going to push through and make it happen. But it takes a toll. And often doctors are very tense and tight and have difficulty sleeping and are kind of wound up all the time. This is beautiful for people in high stress, whether they're doctors or veterans or first responders, or for that matter, people working in office settings with lots of time pressure. This really opens things up. So I recommend it highly. The instructions are, I've given the basic instructions in the transformation. There's much more discussion about this expressive meditation and a bunch of other expressive meditations and how to choose which one works best for you, but all of them can be useful.
Later on in the book, you have this chapter called Reading Leaves on the Family Tree. I thought this was really interesting, and this idea that historical trauma, that is trauma that's been in the past in our family, whether or not, you know, we have knowledge of it, can revisit us. Can you comment about that?
Sure. You're right. It is very important, and the science is actually quite new, demonstrating that this is, in fact, a fact. This is something that people have suspected for a long time, that there was this trauma. If your ancestors were slaves or your ancestors suffered significantly or had to deal with poverty or famine, that somehow those messages got transmitted from one generation to the next. What we didn't know is that this is actually a biological fact and that there are what are called epigenetic changes. That is, changes in the chromosome that affect the way the genes operate in our bodies, that are passed from one generation to the next, and indeed to the next generation after that. And epi is a word that means, or a prefix that means above in Greek. And so it's above the gene. It's not like the mutation in the gene that we learn about in science class where X-rays cause mutation in the structure of the gene, but it's mutation in some of the parts of the chromosome that affect how the gene operates in the body. So, for example, if you're under extreme stress, the epigenetic change makes the gene that is designed to deal with stress can make that gene function less well. And that difficulty functioning, and therefore the difficulty dealing with stress, gets passed from the mother or the father to the child, and from that child to the grandchild as well. And this has been proved. These epigenetic changes have been demonstrated in animal experiments, and a researcher named Rachel Yehuda, who's at Mount Sinai School of Medicine, has demonstrated these same changes in the children and grandchildren of the Holocaust survivors, even when those children and grandchildren have been separated from the grandparents who experienced the trauma of the concentration camps. So this is very, very important. I think the other thing that's important to know, because this sounds pretty ominous, but that like other changes that come about after trauma, these changes can be reversed. And there is already evidence that the techniques that I'm teaching in the transformation can, when they're used together, can reverse these damaging epigenetic changes. And that research has been done by Dean Ornish and his colleagues and Herb Benson and his colleagues And it's more of it is going on at University of California, San Francisco, and at Harvard. In a sense, the bad news is that the trauma, or sometimes the biblical, you call it the sins of the parents are transmitted, but it's the trauma is also transmitted. But the good news is that we can use the approach and the transformation, these simple techniques of self-care, to reverse those epigenetic changes and once again make ourselves much more resilient.
Jim, there are a couple of other things that you focus on in Transformation, your new book, that I thought made sense to me, but were very helpful to remind us of. And those were kind of things that I think we learn even as children, and we kind of forget when we're older, we take for granted. One is gratitude, and the other is forgiveness.
Yeah, and your point is a really good one that I want to emphasize. There are many things that we become naturally to us as children that we lose track of as we move, you know, into our adult life and out into the world and try to take care of business. Let's start with gratitude. Most children are naturally very grateful for whatever happens. Oh, yeah, this is interesting. This is fun to look at. That's there in the child, that capacity for appreciation, which is really just about another word for gratitude. Just being able to appreciate whatever happens in life. That's there. And when the child is unhappy, it's often easy for most children, if their parents can redirect them to something that is gratifying, that they can feel gratitude for. Now, when we're traumatized, we feel, understandably, very put upon. We feel caught in the grip of the trauma that is disabling us. We feel overwhelmed. We feel we have to fend off a danger. We have to fight something. And the notion of being grateful is difficult for us to get our minds around, our being around. So we have to, some of us are naturally grateful. They've been done studies, scientific studies have been done that show that some people just are naturally more appreciative of everything that happens in their life. But many of us are not, so we have to remind ourselves to be grateful. And meditation is just about the quickest, shortest route to gratitude. Because as you sit, breathing slowly and deeply with your belly soft and relaxed, you start appreciating just sitting there, just breathing. Every breath becomes a pleasure. And so gratitude begins to be reintroduced even when we've been traumatized. Forgiveness is a bit harder than gratitude, especially if the trauma that's happened to us has been caused by another person. And yet, forgiveness is such a blessing. Those people who have a difficulty forgiving are far more likely, for example, to have heart disease. And if they have heart disease, they're far more likely to suffer more and die more easily from it. People who are unforgiving are more likely to be depressed, more likely to be anxious, more likely to have difficulty sleeping. So it's not good for us. Forget about the other person. This is about me. It's about you. Doesn't do us any good to be unforgiving.
The name of the book is The Transformation, Discovering Wholeness and Healing After Trauma. And it's by my guest today, Dr. James Gordon, who is the founder and director of the Center for Mind-Body Medicine, where he also is a clinical professor of psychiatry and family medicine at Georgetown University. Jim Gordon, thanks so much for joining us again. It was great to talk to you.
Thank you so much, John. It's good to talk with you. Hope to see you sometime in person, too.
Well, that's our show for this Medical Monday. Studio Tulsa is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of KWGS or the University of Tulsa. For Studio Tulsa, I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. Thanks for listening.